Log Talk Radio.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse.
The beast.
We're told in the book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will uphold you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
Better late than never from the heartland of America. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I am Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to our humble bunker. We're very, very sorry we started late today. We were running into computer problems.
Yeah, it required a restart, and but now once we got that taken care of, I think we're in good shape, and we should be good for the rest of the time that we've allotted. We've actually allotted an hour and a half this time, so as we're not to make ourselves slaves to the 60-minute mark on the clock. So never fear. If you log in early and found we weren't here, we'll make up for it on the back end. So
I'm typing right now, so keep talking.
All right. Today is October 25th, 2014, and plenty to discuss today as we look around at the world and just see a lot of disturbing things taking place out there. Hopefully we can make sense of it and perhaps alleviate some of the fear, the unease that seems to be present out there. I mean, when Ebola becomes a water cooler topic here in the United States, you know, things have ratcheted up a bit. And of course, anytime
you got a water cooler,
a virtual water cooler.
Where'd you get that water cooler?
Virtual water cooler.
Okay. I don't know. Is that in the real world or in the virtual real world?
Is there a difference?
Yes, and we'll talk about that.
Yes. That will be a part of our conversation today. So thank you for joining us wherever you are. It's a beautiful day here in central Illinois. It's one of those days where it's hard to feel bad about being alive no matter what's going on outside. I mean, even though it's late October, unlike many late October days, which tend to be chilly and gray and rainy, today is a beautiful day. I imagine a lot of the farmers in our area, in the Midwestern United States, are out there trying to bring in the crop because it's been dry for the whole week.
Sure they are. In fact, they're probably going to work through the weekend.
Yeah. So a tough way to go if you a big what's up to Johnny from the Iron Show, who's logged into the chat room. Thank you. It's a tough life, and more power to them. I've developed a greater appreciation for what farmers do, even though I'm only one generation removed from life on the farm. My mother was raised on a farm in North Dakota, but somehow I managed to make it to the age of 50 without knowing what silage was. So I've since learned.
I know. I know you have. You've come a long way.
Yeah, many friends now who till the land for their livelihood, and I do have a lot of respect for the amount of work they put in. For example, our friend Jeff, who we don't basically see from the end of September until early November because October is harvest time.
Pretty much, and in the spring it's pretty much
planting.
The same thing. Yeah. And then there's a lot of maintenance during the year. Farmers are busy guys, and what would we do if there were not farmers out there providing the food for our tables?
Exactly right. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we touch on the issue of population, global population, mm-hmm. over the next hour or so, because that's tangentially related, at least.
You're welcome, Johnny.
To the
Johnny just thanked you for the iron promo.
Happy to do it. It's at least tangentially related to the hot topic of the week, which, of course, is Ebola. Anytime something like this happens, anytime something happens that really grabs the attention of a lot of folks, whether it's a disaster or a disease that spreads like Ebola has, there's a subculture out there on the web that starts looking for the conspiratorial angle.
They've got their own water coolers.
Yes, they do.
Yes.
But
I sometimes visit those.
They're wrapped in foil so that they can't be irradiated.
Because if they're irradiated, that's the only way to sanitize
them. That's true.
Exactly. I'm sorry, but you have to do that occasionally.
like the
stuff that builds up on those things.
Like the meat in the grocery store. They have to irradiate it to make it safe. Because there are some disturbing aspects to the Ebola story, but there are other aspects out there, and I just wonder, how far can we go in our distrust of what we hear from the media? Because I know that we, over the past 10 years, have often questioned the official story, and we've mentioned many times that we'll often watch the news just to find out what we're supposed to think or what the elites want us to
we
think.
We no longer have cable, so we're not being programmed anymore.
That's right, yeah. We kind of miss the all the political ads, and I hadn't realized how nice it was not to have to deal with all the ads during election season until this year.
Yes, I know.
I call on customers, 8 to 10 a day, and sometimes the customer will have a television or a radio playing in the waiting room or in the office, and I hear these ads going back and forth, and some of them are just absolutely insane, just, actually accusing members of the other party of committing murder because of their social policies. Like, really?
Get a grip, people.
Please. And I feel some that way about some of the conspiratorial thought, not in the PID Radio Cafe. I think we're pretty on balance. I think we're pretty even keel.
Yeah.
A healthy balance between don't believe everything you read or hear and don't believe anything you read or hear.
And Krispy Kreme references.
And Krispy Kreme references, yeah, which is what keeps you anchored.
Oh, you bet.
Well, the Bible is what keeps
fact,
you anchored.
In fact, the more
the
I
God
eat, the more of an anchor I turn into.
I love your shape, sweetie.
Oh, honey, I love yours too. Mm.
But there are those out there who are actually putting together videos looking for crisis actors among Ebola victims. In other words, there's a belief among some out there that the victims portrayed in some of the news reports about the Ebola outbreak mm-hmm. are actually actors who are hired to play the role of Ebola victims.
I sort of doubt that. It's possible. Anything's possible. I mean, honestly, you watch these stories on the internet. For all I know, they're being written by a robot somewhere.
Yeah, which is possible. I know a lot of sports stories, by the way, are being written
by
a robot.
Oh, yeah,
now.
Lots of stories are being roboticized now.
So, how far do you go down that road? I mean, that way lies madness.
Do robots have their own water coolers, do you think? Probably not.
No, because water, bad. Bad
water,
for robots.
Yes, no. Pretty much.
Yeah. So,
I don't know. I see references to crisis actors. You can name almost any major event that soaks up a lot of headline time in the news. And you'll almost instantly, before the day's out, oh, crisis actors. Did you notice that this one person is the same as this other person?
Mm-hmm.
And look, I've been accused of looking like people all over the place. Oh, you look like my Aunt Jane. You look just like my cousin. You look like a gal I went to high school with. I look like a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
There are only so many looks in the world.
And yet it's amazing that we can distinguish each other, that the Lord gives us enough variety that I know you when I see you, but other people say you look sort of like, that guy that used to be on Saturday Night
Dennis Miller,
Live.
Yeah. Not so much.
And you look kind of like Leonidas.
Sharon is dangerous when she opens up Photoshop.
Hi, Patricia. How are you? She just said hello on the chat room. If you're listening to this in the archives, we just decided to go back to doing a live PID radio for a number of reasons. It makes us, be diligent about setting a time every week that we're going to sit down and do this. That way we don't skip too many weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But it also allows you guys to actually interact. The truth is that many of us are sitting all by ourselves, somewhere in the world, accessing the rest of the world through the internet. And if you can share a live event in a chat room, I think that's sadly about as close as many of us are going to come to, a group a party or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, just a sort of a roundtable discussion. So, bring up your cup of coffee here, even though it's 4 in the afternoon. I'll do coffee until at least 6.
Oh, yeah.
Then we're good.
Krispy Kremes
and or whatever other snacks you engage in, and we appreciate the feedback
this
through
water
the
water cooler.
Exactly. So we appreciate the live feedback from the in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/PID radio. And I just now remembered to start the recording so that the higher audit resolution audio will kind of kick in at about the 10-minute mark on the archive show at PIDradio.com.
I see that Johnny is asking for a 5 or 10 minute virus lesson.
Well, since
we
started
down
that
road. Well, I could do that, but honestly, I'd bore most of the people. Let's just say that they are not living. They are not dead. Viruses are hackers.
Yeah.
You just hack yourself.
Well, the virus is essentially what? It's a protein coat with around a single strand of, what is it, RNA?
It's usually RNA. Sometimes they're double-stranded RNA. Sometimes they're actually DNA. But in the case of Ebola, it's a negatively charged single-stranded RNA genome has seven genes.
Mm-hmm.
Around that is a small protein coat or capsid. And then around that is this envelope that's actually made up of the previous victim's cell membrane.
So that it fools the body's...
Exactly. It goes in and says, hi, I'm friendly, let me in. It does a little handshake with its glycoprotein, and in it goes. And once it's in, it hijacks your cell's metabolic pathway to make copies of itself. And from there, it just, it'll eject thousands of copies of itself from that cell, and the cell dies.
You know, I know you've told me this before, but the image of this just really finally sunk into me. These are like little miniature microscopic versions of skinwalkers. They put on the skin of its victims.
That's exactly what it is.
Ugh.
It's terrifying. And I make the claim now. There are going to be some out there that are telling me I'm just wacky, but I think that if you believe in Genesis 6, if you believe the fallen angels came and messed around with humans by interacting physically with females and producing giants, I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that they may also have created metabolic molecular machines that or hacking machines called viruses. They have been around since the dawn of time.
And the Ebola virus, from a genetic component, is not very sophisticated, is it? How many genes does the Ebola...
Seven genes.
Hmm.
Doesn't take much, does it?
Johnny asks, what about recombinant DNA via a virus? Can that work?
To fight it?
To perhaps create a more virulent strain.
That can happen. In fact, one of the vaccines that's out there, one of the vaccine candidates... is a recombinant rabies virus.
Recombinant rabies virus?
Yeah. Hey, it's been taught how to express the Ebola glycoproteins on its outer membrane, which is also the coat of the previous host.
So the idea is that by expressing the
It teaches Ebola. Your body to recognize the Ebola glycoprotein, which is just a sugar molecule mm-hmm. that's on the outside of that virus. Your body sees that
mm-hmm.
and says, oh my gosh. I don't like the looks of this. Let's figure out what this is. And it learns how to combat it. Now, when you get infected with actual Ebola, your body's also trying very hard to figure out who this is, why things are going wrong in the body, who do we need to bring in, messengers are sent out. The initial guys that come in are usually the complement system, C3, C4, C8. Those guys send out text messages, essentially called cytokines. These cytokines are a type of message, a hormone that goes out and tries to bring in the cavalry. In the case of Ebola, they actually stimulate a cytokine storm. So you've got like a denial of service attack going onto your body because tons of cytokine messages are being sent out, and they're calling for all of the cytokines that cause us to express a fever and all of the other things that happen in our bodies, but not the good cytokine messages calling on interferon, which is one of the chemicals that comes in and actually helps your body to combat the invader.
They're jamming the signals.
The signals
that your body needs to actually generate the antibodies.
Sounds pretty evil, doesn't it?
It sounds like it was designed specifically to do what it does.
It's not the only virus that does that. Smallpox does something similar. Even though it's not typically, it's not in the same family as Ebola. Ebola is a part of the Filoviridae family.
Mm-hmm.
Smallpox, oh gosh, I don't have the name of that. Poxmiridae? No, I'd have to go look. But it's a different family of viruses. It still has a hemorrhagic component some of the time, and that's called blackpox.
Mm.
In blackpox, your whole body starts to turn into these awful-looking bumps. Lumps and bumps that are just blood blisters. And eventually you get so much blood pooling underneath your skin that you can literally shed your skin.
Ugh.
It's a terrible way to die.
Johnny clarifies his question. He was actually asking whether a virus could be used to mutate your DNA to turn you into something else.
Very possibly. Viruses do that all the time.
Really?
Well, they go in and they leave little bits of themselves. When they go in and they hijack your internal machinery within the nucleus, they sometimes leave little bits of themselves behind. That's what the BRCA, the breast cancer one. It's the BRC.
Okay, and it causes then the cells that are that have these this little bit of genetic material in them to grow without.
Well, it can mess up the protein that it's supposed to. Say if you have a gene that is supposed to encode for insulin receptor, mm-hmm. which is a very common receptor on the outside of your cells. I think it's a 7-pass protein, which means it goes out, in, out, in, out. So it passes through the – actually, that was 5. It passes through an odd number of times so that starts on one side, ends on the other side. And whenever a sugar molecule comes in, glucose molecule comes in close to that cell, the insulin receptor is changed because it actually is like lock and key. Mm-hmm. It causes that receptor protein – I'm drawing in the air for Derek mm-hmm. – to actually change on the inside of the cell.
Mm.
And that causes this whole cascade to happen inside the cell. It's amazing that anybody can take a look at cellular mechanics and believe that all of this happened
by accident.
By accident and trial and error. Yeah. It is the craziest belief. But yes, viruses, when they enter your body, they often leave little bits behind. And if it is in that insulin receptor gene, when the insulin receptor gene is altered in a way that changes the shape, again, it has to go a certain way and lock and key and change, mm-hmm. it may not work anymore.
Hmm. And if you can't, if that takes place where you can no longer properly process because the shape is now different, process insulin, am I understanding correctly?
That's very possible, yeah.
That your body is no longer able to... I mean, that insulin is a key component in just metabolic metabolism, right?
Exactly. And it's one of the reasons you and I talk all day long. Right now, I am on a low-carb diet. I'm having a hard time with this.
Yeah,
I love carbs.
No Krispy
Kreme. I joke about Krispy Kremes. I only eat those once a year.
Yeah.
Every year on my birthday, which is coming up, I get a box of Krispy Kremes, and I eat, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 of them. And the rest of them, we either, you know, put in the freezer or give away or whatever, but my sister sometimes helps. I don't eat a whole lot of sweets per se, but I love bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I bake fresh bread almost every day, don't I, honey?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it's whole wheat. I mean, it's 9-grain bread. It's really good for you, but I'm trying to lose a little bit of weight and get a little bit healthier. So, and this is a long story short, too late. My blood sugar is going crazy the last few days. It tends to sort of not be as even as it should be anyway.
Right.
Sometimes I have what's called reactive hypoglycemia, which means I can eat something and within half an hour I feel like I have not eaten. My blood sugar just goes through the floor.
Yeah. Now, for the last couple of months, I've been trying something, and not to deviate too far from the Ebola
thing.
But
I think this is important.
Stuff.
No,
yeah, I'm going to pass this on to you as a tip because it seems to be working for me. I just want to remind you, we're going to come back to the Ebola story here because there's an important aspect of this, and we got some audio from a press conference that took place earlier this week that we'll play, which is significant. But years ago, 9-10 years ago, there was a morning team in St. Louis. And in fact, I've since interviewed both of those gentlemen on A View from the Bunker. Tim Behrens and Al Gross hosted a morning show on KJSL in St. Louis, which was AM 560. And AM 630. They talked for every morning about this Bragg's apple cider vinegar that they were taking. And every morning they'd take a shot glass full of it. Sometimes they'd mix it with juice or whatever.
I don't know how they talked after that.
Well, it's difficult because when you take it straight, the burning, it is pretty intense. But it's raw, unfiltered apple cider vinegar with what they call the mother, which is the cloudy pulp, the enzymes.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, the good stuff. And they claimed it was helping them lose weight. It was, and there were other people who claimed that it helps cure your arthritis and stuff like that. I haven't noticed any improvement in my, minor arthritis that I'm developing, but I have noticed that I've dropped a few pounds and I've not really changed my eating habits all that much. And so I started doing some research online. What is it with this raw, unfiltered apple cider vinegar that seems to benefit metabolism? And apparently the raw, unfiltered apple cider vinegar will help the body with its insulin uptake. It levels it out so that if you do have carbs for breakfast, for example, a bowl of breakfast cereal, which our doctor, who is very much into talking about glycemic the glycemic index causes what he says, glycemic shock. He said, if you have a bowl of cereal for breakfast, you might as well be eating a Snickers bar, a candy bar.
Yeah.
Because your body converts a lot of it into sugars, and then because you can't absorb it all, a lot of it gets turned into fat. Apparently, the apple cider vinegar levels that out so that your body takes it in at a instead of getting a sugar rush and then a crash later on, it levels it out so that you can get almost – I can get to lunchtime pretty much anymore.
Now, mind you, it doesn't mean that you can eat a Snickers bar for breakfast.
No, it does not. But what it does is it makes sure that if you are going to have some carbs like a bowl of cornflakes or, you know, whatever, that your body's not going to, you know, convert it all into sugar right away, overwhelm your body's ability to take it in, and then convert what's left into fat, which means you're going to be gaining weight, even though you may be eating a reasonable number of calories per day. So anyway, the evidence is – the jury is still out, but there's some evidence that suggests that raw apple cider vinegar helps your body level that out, and they recommend a tablespoon or two before breakfast, and then again either in the evening before dinner or before bedtime, just to help your body level out these things so you're not getting these glycemic spikes and then crashes.
Yeah.
Which leaves you feeling like you got to eat more, like Sharon described, because you're suddenly hungry again because now your body is starved for sugar. And then when you're in that sugar rush phase, it's converting the excess to fat. So you're eating a normal amount, but your body's not processing it right. And this Now, again, I'll say that this Bragg's raw, unfiltered apple cider vinegar, when you take it straight, is pretty potent.
Oh, my gosh. In fact, there's a warning that if you continue taking it straight, you may actually risk the lining of your esophagus.
Yeah, you don't want that. So mix it with something. I was going to look for this at the grocery store tonight, so some cranberry juice. Mixed it with the cranberry juice. It was fine. If you mix it with a little sweet tea. Mm-hmm. I found it gives it kind of a citrusy kick, which actually tastes really good.
Yeah.
But if you try to mix it with water just to dilute it, okay, you can do that, but it's still pretty sour.
Yeah, I'm going to have to find some cranberry juice or something. Right. Something that's just pure juice and no sugar added, because if I have sweet tea, that's sort of undoing everything I'm trying to do.
Yeah. So, So anyway, it seems to be working for me. I've dropped about 5-6 pounds over the last couple of months, and I've not really changed.
Well, you've seen his picture. I posted it at the Gilbert House Fellowship website. I mean, he just looks, you're awesome. And that dog with you,
right, that's true. Yeah.
He's been taking it too.
Salmonitis. Yeah. So anyway, you can find it online, Amazon.com. There are a couple of places. In fact, I found a place that sells it for a lower cost than the company that produces it, Bragg's.
I don't know how they do it. Yeah. I really don't. Unless they're taking the old bottles and filling them up with, I don't know, battery acid or something. Maybe that's why it's so strong. We'll be happy to post in the show notes the link to the place where you can order it if you want to try some. It's really not expensive. The biggest thing is that it's like $5 shipping, but that's for two bottles.
Yeah, a couple of 32-ounce bottles. So that's really pretty inexpensive. So like 64 ounces of it is about $14, which is not bad.
That includes the shipping.
Including shipping, right. So anyway, the first bottle I found was at a small country market run by a Mennonite family down in far southern Illinois, and that was like $9 just for a 16-ounce bottle. So
that's it, honey. That's how we'll support our full-time ministry. We'll open up a roadside stand.
There we go, selling apple cider vinegar and handmade crafts. Yes.
There you go.
Well, anyway, back to the topic of the day. Earlier this week, Tuesday, the head of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, CIDRAP, at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Michael Osterholm, who was appointed to the post about 9 years ago. So he's been in this position since 2005.
Well, I think he helped to establish CIDRAP, too.
Yeah.
So he's been around for a long time. He is a very respected scientist.
Yeah. He mentioned that some research has been done on the strain of Ebola that was isolated in Guinea, which is one of the hotspots for the disease. And he said there was a very disturbing discovery that was made when they injected that strain into monkeys.
Today I've been given permission, something I've known about for a few weeks. When I wrote the piece, I knew about this, and it's concerned me greatly. Gary Kobinger and colleagues at Winnipeg, the Canadian National Lab, actually took one of the strains from Guinea and put it into macaques a little over a month and a half ago. What they saw was remarkable. It was unlike any of the Ebola viruses they've seen in monkeys. It was much, much more severe. The pathology in the lungs was remarkable. And as Gary said, who is one of the most prominent Ebola virologists in the world, said, it is very worrisome to me about what I saw there. Maybe this is a different virus. Maybe there is that possibility. Because if you have that much virus in the lungs, maybe somebody might cough it up, and maybe you might get a cycle. Now, I'm not saying that here to scare people. Plan B. What the hell are we going to do if we suddenly see the potential for transmission that might be respiratory in nature? Do we have a plan? I don't know if it's a 1 in 1 million chance. I don't know if it's a 1 in 100,000. But the point of it is, if we can't talk about that because people say you're scaring people, and, you know, the blowback has been substantial, you know, I guess I'm getting old. It doesn't bother me so much anymore. Because it was all based on what I believed to be the true science. And it wasn't an attempt to scare. It was an attempt to have people think about this. What would if we had another black swan event where now we really had a reason to be concerned about airplanes? I don't know what that chance is, but I want somebody to be thinking about it. I want a plan. And it's not based on just idle speculation.
That's Dr. Michael Alsterholm of SIDRAP talking about the research that's been done by the head of the Canadian lab, and the fact that it appears to be more infectious, especially in lung tissue, mm-hmm. than what they had previously seen. Now, this was something that the ability of this to be transmitted through the air has been known since the initial outbreak recorded in the book Hot Zone.
Yeah, the Reston,
right.
Ebola Reston. Which actually, if you're unfamiliar with it, in 1991, something like that, don't have the date in front of me, a shipment of macaque monkeys came from the Philippines, I think.
Yes.
Arrived in Reston, Virginia. The rules are that if you bring in monkeys for lab testing, they have to be quarantined to make sure that they're not carrying any exotic illnesses. And each shipment of monkeys has to be put into its own room within this large holding facility. And the facility in this case was in Reston, Virginia. Shortly after the arrival of the new macaques, Dalgard was the name of the veterinarian who was in charge of the facility. He noticed he had monkeys dying in that room and in another room. Room F and the other room, and I can't remember the number of that room, the letter of that room, was far down the hall. So these are monkeys separated by a long distance, and the only thing connecting the two rooms was a hallway and ductwork. It was ruled out that any of the caretakers was transmitting the disease from one room to another via the hallway. It was finally ruled that the disease itself, Ebola, was somehow transmitted through the ductwork, the air conditioning and heating ductwork. I don't know if you recorded this part, but Dr. Alsterholm mentions this research that came out from USAMRIID shortly after the Reston event.
Yeah.
And the USAMRIID study found that indeed there is such a thing as airborne Ebola, and monkeys can get sick. And Dr. Alsterholm references one of the common complaints and criticisms of that study, saying
yes.
that, well, it was just the monkey poop, which drops on the floor. And when you hit it with a high pressure hose or you start to sweep it, then it gets into the air and it gets into the you know, it travels down the hall. I was watching this video earlier this week, and I said the same thing before Dr. Alsterholm even said it. I said out loud, that's worse.
Yeah, because those who are trying to keep a lid on public panic, which was the point of his opening remark, that he'd been asked not to talk about this for fear of creating a panic.
Yeah.
There were those who, and that incident, by the way, in Reston, Virginia, took place in 1989.
Oh, sorry. The book came out in 91.
I think the book was 96.
Yeah. I think the USAMRIID study was not too long after that event.
Right. And they were saying, no, it's not transmissible through the air, but it might have been stirred up by sweeping up the monkey droppings. And again, what Sharon's point is, that's worse because when you cough, you are essentially aerosolizing droplets of fluid, the mucal lining of your lungs or
the sputum that comes out when you talk.
Right, right.
When you cough. Or sing.
Yeah.
I used to sing opera, and I would watch the other performers on the stage, and you could just see it going down into the poor orchestra pit.
Yes.
And they often joked and said that they would start wearing umbrellas.
Putting salad bar shields between the orchestra pit.
But, I mean, imagine if you are close enough to someone that your spit, as you're speaking or coughing, hits them in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
You have potentially infected that person.
Right. And, you know, in the, being in the radio business as long as I was, I used to see that a lot. I mean, here we're using little pop shields, but in a radio studio, typically they'll use those big foam, you know, covers that will, as pop filters. And after a while, in a radio studio, there were guys who were really cautious about that because, you know, if you talk for a living, you lose your voice, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, radio, you could tell how long the microphone had been in service, or at least the foam pop filter had been in service, by how much it smelled of Lysol.
Ew.
And in some cases, Lysol and cigarettes, which was worse.
Well, Lysol doesn't kill everything.
No, it doesn't. Ew. But it was not pleasant. So I tended not to work the microphones very close. There were some guys who got right up on the microphone because they liked what's called the proximity effect, because it made your voice sound lower, like you need to get right on top of it like this. And, you know, so one guy gets sick, pretty soon the whole air staff was sick.
Yeah.
But you cannot cough
down an air duct.
Exactly. And so the point being, with the initial study in Ebola, when it first was identified here in the U.S., 1989, was that it was traveling through the air.
Yes.
And so the information that we've been getting about this Ebola outbreak since it crossed the ocean, even before it crossed the ocean, because if you've been listening to PID radio and paying attention, we've been talking about this outbreak since last December, I think.
Well,
that's
I've
when
been
you first noticed
it, yeah.
But we at least mentioned it before it really came to the public's attention in July. But you've known since I was
knee high to a grasshopper.
96 that this was transmissible through the air, and that the information from the CDC and the Obama administration was just flat out not true.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, and Dr. Osterholm makes a very disturbing speculation. What happens if we do have another black swan event, something unexpected, where I presume when he's talking about a black swan event, the virus mutating into a more transmissible form.
Yes. And that's entirely possible. One of the reasons that we are safe so far is because the USAMRIID study and the Reston event seems to indicate that human lung tissue is not one of the favorite haunts for the Ebola virus. It doesn't have a really firm handshake with those cells, so it can't get in as easily. Those cells aren't fooled. But the day's coming when it mutates enough that our lung tissue goes, hey, come on in. And when that happens, Katie, bar the door.
Yeah. Now, the reason, and we're kind of working our way around, and we'll tie some threads together here, including the thread earlier about, you know, growing food.
And the water cooler.
No, forget the water cooler. The water cooler has nothing to do with this.
That's way over the top. Forget we even said it.
The Obama administration, as we mentioned last week, named Ron Klain, who was a career attorney and operative for the Democratic Party. He served as Joe Biden's chief of staff. He served as the point man for the recount that never ended in Florida back in 2000. Was it 2000? Between George W. Bush.
Chad's out to dry.
Yeah. So political operative and attorney Ron Klain suddenly named the point man in the fight against Ebola. He is the Ebola czar.
Yeah.
Now, beyond the obvious question, which is why nominate an attorney or name an attorney to this post instead of somebody with a medical health background, especially since there is a post within the Centers for Disease Control already designated as the person responsible for emergency responses.
Why, yes, there is.
The point is that Klain, in a videotaped interview from 2008, responded to a question from an interviewer at Georgetown University about the top challenge facing world leaders. And Klain declared that not lack of medical care, war, disease, or poverty being the top challenge facing mankind. He said overpopulation was the top challenge. Now, of course, you know, that was 6 years ago. People change over the course of 6 years or so, but there are those who find it just a little disturbing that somebody is put in charge of fighting a virulent disease with a 70% lethality rate, who believes that mankind's biggest problem is overpopulation.
Yeah, that's just, and someone who's not even an MD. I mean, he's a lawyer, for goodness sake.
Yeah. And to the best of our knowledge, Ebola does not respect or honor injunctions.
However, the Assistant Secretary of HHS, Dr. Nicole Laurie,
yes,
should have been in charge of all this. And I watched her testify before the House committee. I'm not really sure what the name of the committee was. A bunch of guys trying to ask about Ebola. mostly Republicans, by the way.
Yeah.
She was asked point blank a number of times, why is it you weren't put in charge? Where have you been all along? Why have we not seen you on this? Why mm-hmm. are you not? Why is it the CDC guy who's the head of this? You know what her response was? Even though she is technically the head person for any pandemic within the borders of the United States, she said this is not a problem within our borders. This is an international problem. Therefore, the CDC, as part of the World Health Organization, takes the lead.
Oh, that's very interesting.
In other words, we don't get to make this choice. This is not a national. This is an international. That's why the World Health Organization is the kingpin. And they have the right to shut down travel if they want to.
Yeah. I should have grasped this last week when we were talking about it. But you're right. That essentially what that means is the Obama administration is turning over the lead to the United Nations on this.
Yep.
Oh.
I think Ron Klain was hired because he is a former lobbyist. He is a lawyer. And he has a lot of contacts, not just within the Beltway, but also with the media.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that some phone calls were made. Let's put a lid on this. We don't want people to panic.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand that. I really can. Because if you're, you know, over 30, especially if you're over 40, you probably remember some of the early days, or you've heard your parents talk about the early days of the HIV epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
What do we keep hearing Tom Frieden from the CDC saying over and over, and I'm starting to hear it repeated as talking points.
Yeah.
This is like the HIV epidemic
right.
all over again.
Right, meaning it'll
two
be
reasons.
With us.
Yes, it'll be with us for a long time, and we're stumbling to try to figure out what to do. So bear with us. That's really what he's saying, because in the early days of the HIV epidemic, they're trying to keep a lid on the panic that happened then. There was a lot of panic happening. People were not aware that it was just a sexually transmitted disease. At least that's, you know, and you can get it through blood.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not something that you can catch just by being in the same room with somebody.
Mm.
Well, Ebola might be something you can catch by being in the same room with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, think about it. Ebola emerged in 1976. How many times have you read a story about a doctor, and there are lots of them who have worked with the Doctors Without Borders, the French group Médecins Sans Frontières, mm-hmm. however that's pronounced. Lots of wonderful people, healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, all sorts of great folks have been going over to Africa since 1976
mm-hmm.
and helping out over there. You don't very often read about one of those healthcare workers coming back with Ebola, do you?
No, that's very true. You don't.
Nope. And there have been many outbreaks since 1976. This is the first one in West Africa.
Mm-hmm. And that raises an interesting question. And, you know, we'll come back to the population thing, but I think that's jump in on the question that has been raised about why we're suddenly seeing Ebola raging through West Africa and why not just Dr. Osterholm, but another top scientist, Dr. Peter Jarling, who is
he's one of the granddaddies,
chief scientist at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases,
is
saying that this appears to be a new strain. Is it possible that this is an accidental release from something that the United States has been working on?
Sure,
in
it
West
is.
Africa.
Sure, it is. I don't think we would be told if it were.
No, of course we wouldn't.
I'd say that it's very possible also that this is simply something that occurred from an infection that happened perhaps from, because viruses mutate even within this outbreak. It's mm-hmm. been slowly mutating. It could be that someone traveled from Democratic Republic of Congo,
mm-hmm.
which is former Zaire, or one of those areas, Sudan, Uganda, and travel over to West Africa and brought a disease with them. I mean, that's how we got it here.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody came here. The very first patient that is being reported, the official timeline, is that it began in February or March. I think it's March.
Yes.
A child was bitten by a bat, they're saying,
right.
and spread it to her family. It's possible that something like that is actually how it broke out, but I'd say it's also very possible because there are labs over there trying to research Ebola.
That's what I'm trying to pull up is the notes that I saved here. The U.S. has been conducting germ research around the world.
Well, I think we've had a lab in Kanema, Liberia.
Pulling this up
right
now.
That was part of the DOD Tulane partnership.
Well, that's the information I'm trying to pull up here right now. And of course, the Obama administration has said we're gonna clamp down on this research, which is sort of a tacit admission that we're doing research.
I think Liberia told him to stop.
Yeah. Let's see. I thought I had it here, and I don't have it. But the United States has been conducting research in the very region where the Ebola outbreak took place. We've got a lab conducting research, a U.S. AMRID facility in Monrovia, which is the largest city in Liberia, the third largest city in Sierra Leone.
Yeah. Here's the question. If you're going to, and this is, I think, where my, okay, let me just put this tinfoil hat right on my head. Let me adjust it so it's very stylish. If we've not had any outbreak prior to this in West Africa and you want to study Ebola, why not go to where it's broken out traditionally in former Zaire, in Uganda,
right,
in Sudan, along the Ebola River,
mm-hmm,
which is how it got its name. Rather, no, we put it in West Africa, which seems really odd.
Well, the fact is we may be doing them in both places because, again, looking at the beginning of this article here, the U.S. has been conducting research in let's see, how many different facilities around the world?
A lot.
Over 100.
Well, that's how I'm going to get cut him slack because in order to find ways to combat a disease, you have to study the disease. And if it's one that is endemic within a population, that's where you go to study it.
Right. The question is, do you need to work on aerosolizing such an agent in order to study it?
If you want to find out if it can infect someone through an aerosol, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You do. And one way you do that is just to put the virus within a liquid and then spray it through an atomizer.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Francis Boyle, this was what I was trying to find. Dr. Francis Boyle actually wrote some legislation that the United States passed in the 1980s.
He's an attorney, just so you know. His doctorate is, I think, a law degree.
Right. Dr. Boyle is on the board of directors of Amnesty International, and he's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois, just up the road from us here. But
in fact, he's in the backyard.
He wrote the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, which was the implementation legislation for the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. So this is a guy who's been studying it for 40-some-odd years, but he says that the United States does have weapons, infectious disease laboratories in, Western Africa. He's the source for that information.
I will say this. He's very anti-U.S.
Okay.
Just so you understand that.
Yeah, so he's got a perspective.
He definitely has an agenda.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean what he's saying isn't true.
Yeah. And we are not making the claim by any stretch of the imagination that the United States is deliberately releasing any
agent. No, and that's why I keep saying that it could be that this is simply everything that they've told us it is.
Right. It could very well be, but I think we also need to consider the possibility that this is an accident.
Concerning.
Yeah, this could be an accident. Something that was being done at a laboratory to research the threat to humanity,
mm-hmm,
and something got loose.
Yeah.
And this has happened many times. In fact, there were stories that came out over the last year or so that we talked about the CDC inadvertently sending a strain of infectious avian flu to a laboratory that had wanted a less virulent strain of flu for research, influenza virus. We talked about the researcher, and I can't think of his last name, a Japanese scientist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, who recreated the 1918 Spanish flu virus.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2006 and 2007, there was debate taking place essentially a competition being held by the Department of Homeland Security, taking bids from various research facilities around the country for NBAF, the National Bio and Agro Defense research facility to replace Plum Island. Plum Island is an aging facility. They say it's too small. It doesn't have a biosecurity level 4 laboratory on site, which it needs to research things like anthrax and hoof and mouth and things like that. But the reason it's on Plum Island is because it's off the east coast of Long Island, and the prevailing winds blow out to sea. So if something does get released, which has happened accidentally, the winds carry it out to sea where there's no livestock to be infected. Manhattan, Kansas, Kansas State University wound up winning the bid. It has still not been constructed, although construction did start in 2012. They're targeting 2015 as an opening date, but that's been
delayed. Apparently, they just weren't shovel ready.
Yeah,
there was all that
not.
Money available.
Yeah, so it's over. It was at the time $500 million. Now the budget is up to $714 billion for the $714 million for the project at Kansas State.
Well, even
but
if
again,
you're a
the
BSL.
objection to having a laboratory like that, especially one that's researching BSL-4. Agents is that it's in the middle of America's heartland. And if something like, forget anthrax, just if hoof and mouth gets out into the population, which can be spread by deer, and there are just a few deer in the Midwestern United States, we can tell you, we can see them in our neighborhood from time to time. They can go from farm to farm, as they will often do, as they forage in the wintertime, and can spread hoof and mouth from pigs to cattle and cause an economic disaster of unprecedented proportions here in the United States, which was the argument against having it in Manhattan, Kansas.
I'm glad you brought up pigs.
Oh, really?
I am, because I just wanted to make sure everybody knows that pigs can catch Ebola. Pigs can also catch Marburg, which is the sister virus to Ebola.
Yeah.
So, in fact, the areas where Marburg is endemic, which is, again, that same area around Sudan and Uganda and or along the Ebola River, that area, the farmers have been told to be very, very careful about when they work with pigs, because it's possible that they can catch the virus from the pig.
Huh.
So whether or not we can catch Ebola from pigs, I don't know, but you might want to keep an eye on your swines there.
Yeah, disturbing. And just to circle back around to the Ebola czar, the science czar in the Obama administration, John Holdren, also a believer that overpopulation is one of the biggest problems facing humanity.
There's a thread here.
Yeah, he co-wrote that book with Paul Ehrlich, who was the guy who was behind what was the book, The Population Bomb?
That sounds right.
Well, something like that. But the concept being that we were reaching the carrying capacity of Earth, would soon overrun it, and then we would all starve to death.
Yeah, the Malthusian.
The Malthusian nightmare. Mm-hmm, we debated that when I was in high school.
I know, but look, that's just ate up.
No, overpopulation is not the problem that the alarmists would like us to believe. We will probably, according to information I've been reading today, hit 9 billion. We're at like 7.1, 7.2 billion on Earth right now. We're supposed to hit about 9 billion around 2050. But then the population is supposed to level off and then begin to decline.
Exactly.
Because most of us in the Western world are not having babies at a rate to maintain the population.
Well, I don't think that we're going to be around that long anyway. I know you and I just where our lifespans are going to be up by then. But sure. I think Jesus is coming back before any of that.
I think you're probably right about that. So,
but I wanted to say a minute ago, and I apologize for sort of jumping in.
Go ahead.
BSL-4 labs are extremely tight as far as they're trying to make sure that viruses and pathogens don't get out. But sometimes they're not great at their bookkeeping. I mean, just earlier this year, we saw story after story of the NIH and the CDC and all sorts of locations that were finding, we just found these germs here in the lab. Oh, look, they're smallpox samples over here. They've been unrefrigerated in a closet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that has happened more than a couple of times, sadly. There are things that have gone unaccounted for that should have been accounted for.
Well, here's what happens. People send in samples, and it's going on now. We're not sure if this patient has XYZ. We're going to send a sample, and they have to be inside very carefully designed tubes and then protected for all sorts of reasons and then protected again and buffered and then shipped. Sometimes they leak, and if they're not put together correctly, they will leak.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they get to that lab and they're just set aside because the lab is inundated, and I bet they are. There are only a few labs that can do the definitive test. There are quick tests that are PCR tests that you're seeing a lot of these. Oh, they tested negative. And then they have to wait and send the for the confirmation test from one of these labs that has the it takes a, like 48 hours, 24 hours. And the irony of that testing is that did you know that the hospital down in Texas had a unit that was approved by the DOD for doing a very quick, it only takes about an hour, mm-hmm. a quick test for, excuse me, for Ebola. And they couldn't use it because it wasn't approved by their hospital system or...
insurance, probably.
Yeah, probably insurance. It wasn't approved by somebody, so they couldn't use it, even though they could have known within a very short period of time that Thomas Eric Duncan had Ebola.
You know, it's frightening when we hear things like that. And it just makes me step back a minute and think about the foolishness of those who, you know, the progressives who think that the government should be in charge of everything because that's the way to make sure that everything gets done the way it is. It's like, look, have you paid any attention at all when you've had to go get a driver's license as to how efficiently that process runs? Why do you think this other stuff is going to work any better?
Take a number, please.
Yeah. Holy moly. Well, It can be disturbing and really frightening, and we just, you know, pray that as we talk about this that we don't go too far down the down that road because we're not trying to stir up the adrenaline rush.
No, we're really not. We would. I am a firm believer that if people are given the truth, that we can handle it. It's only when we get different versions of the current truth. As if we're not, you know, you get this sense that we're not being told the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there was a press conference that was given in New York earlier today. And I posted a video from that press conference because the main camera appeared to be on the interpreter for the deaf.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it was almost as if he were trying to audition for Saturday Night Live. It made the entire event, the entire presser seemed like it was lighthearted.
It almost, the guy almost looked like that guy who was speaking at the, what was it? The memorial service for, what was it? You remember the guy who was standing next to the South African president
Obama? He was signing?
The way he was signing. He was just making stuff up.
I was going to say, it didn't look like him at all.
No, but it almost was that same sort of effect where it looked like it was.
Yeah. And I think he was genuinely signing. It's
yes.
just that he was doing with such enthusiasm and over the top facial and body gestures that it was as if he was making a commentary. And like I said, he appeared to be making almost a joke out of the proceedings with a very serious topic. And in the meantime, because he's so over the top, you're probably paying more attention to him than you were to the actual voice that was speaking. The doctor who was, or I assume a doctor.
But it was a distraction.
It was a distraction because the information being given from every study that I have read was incorrect.
Hmm.
And I really believe that the American public, if you tell us the truth, we can take it.
Yeah. It's certainly because we're smart enough to know when we're...
So who in the chain is lying? Because it's possible that the talking heads on, you know, sitting on these panels and doing the, you know, the PR person or the public relations person for, you know, XYZ government... they're telling exactly what they think is true.
Mm-hmm.
Politicians saying exactly what they believe to be true. But it's insane. It's almost, you know, we're getting back to the crisis actors things. There are aspects of some of these events that do make you wonder.
Yeah.
For instance, in New York, where a Dr. O'Craig, what's his last name? The young man who has just been...
Spencer.
Spencer, thank you. Dr.
Yeah.
Craig Spencer. Who came back from serving in West Africa with Doctors Without Borders. He foolishly, I believe, I consider it foolish behavior. If he knew he should be self-quarantining and you know, self-monitoring, he went out and bowled and spent a couple of three nights doing all sorts of things with friends. Now the authorities have to track down everyone within that chain and make sure that everybody is okay.
Right.
The New York City policeman who went to his apartment and were dressed in modified hazmat materials based on what I saw, were discarding their used gloves and hazmat wear into a public trash can.
Yeah, that was bizarre. And there are photos documenting that. So that's, again, that's not conspiracy theory.
Yeah,
that's,
and I, the reason I even found out about that is because I was watching the C-SPAN House testimony, and one of the guys, one of the congressmen was waving this picture from where he'd printed it out, and he said, "This happened this morning.
Yeah.
How do you explain this?"
Yeah. We're doing all we can. We're cooperating here.
Yeah, well, it's almost like we're trying very hard to. It's almost like those policemen didn't take it seriously. Well, you know, this is nothing. He's
or
okay.
They just haven't been trained. They really don't understand.
Well, I would like to think that that's what it is, because you can be trained, but if you simply refuse to take the Ebola crisis seriously, it could be deadly.
Or if they've been, well, again, if they've been trained to say, unless you touch his blood or sweat or whatever, then you're okay, which is not necessarily true.
Well, that is not necessarily true.
So, well, we'll keep an eye on that, of course. And, of course, Sharon's book is coming out in November, Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse.
Yeah, it'll probably be late in November.
Yeah, so sometime around the week of Thanksgiving. And hopefully by then we can give thanks that the thing has burned itself out.
I pray we can. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah. I found an interesting item today, which kind of relates to another topic that we've been researching, which is transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points that I made in my presentation about transhumanism at the Pikes Peak Prophecy Summit was that rather than leading to one of the supposed benefits that the transhumanists point to when they say this technology will make us all enhance us all so that we can become the cognitive equivalent of gods, demigods, mm-hmm. where we can interface with the with technology,
Christ
and,
consciousness,
and become part of the iMind, basically plug into the internet and be millions, billions of times more intelligent than we are right now, which is somehow supposed to be a good thing. Very Eastern in its origins, by the way, very Eastern in its religious outlook. The mm-hmm. the sublimation of self into the whole, frankly. You know, I know I'm not God, but I like myself, and I don't want to be a non-person. I don't want to, you know, give up my self-consciousness and be part of, you know, I reject that. I think that's a bad thing. But be that as it may, my point was that rather than leading to this sort of egalitarian utopia where everybody gets to upgrade, what's really going to happen is that the elite, those who are financially well off, will be the ones most likely to afford the various types of upgrades that transhumanism promises, whether it's merging with technology or being able to select the genetic traits that you want for your children in the womb or before they're born.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, designer babies. There was a book written about 20 years ago called The Bell Curve, which was very controversial because he pointed out some differences in standard IQ tests between the different races. That's not really the point of what I'm saying here, but there was a conclusion to the
just
book,
call
which
them purple penguins.
Yeah, exactly. In the conclusion to their book, they wrote this, and I think this really relates to that particular point about transhumanism, that it will just give the elites a more entrenched position atop the social and economic structure. They wrote, and I quote from The Bell Curve, "Predicting the course of society is chancy, but certain tendencies seem strong enough to worry about. An increasingly isolated cognitive elite, a merging of the cognitive elite with the affluent, a deteriorating quality of life for people at the bottom end of the cognitive distribution. Unchecked, these trends will lead the U.S. towards something resembling a caste society, with the underclass mired ever more firmly at the bottom end, at the bottom, and the cognitive elite ever more firmly anchored at the top, restructuring the rules of society so that it becomes harder and harder for them to lose." Their point was that during the 20th century, picking up on some trends, that the colleges became better and better about finding the cognitive elite, in other words, the brightest minds,
mm-hmm.
and directing them towards the top colleges and universities. And that as our society transformed from a manufacturing society, an industrial society, to more of an information society, brain power became a better determinant of getting a good job and becoming a member of the economic elite.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you've got this merger now of the cognitive and the economic elite, the affluent, and that transhumanism, in my view, when you look at those trends, will only exacerbate the trend that the affluent will be most likely to select genetic traits for their children to make them smarter, healthier, and better
because
looking.
Because they'll have the money to do it.
Because they'll have the money to do it. While those at the bottom of the economic or socioeconomic ladder will find it harder and harder to climb up because now not only are you having to compete from a position of weakness, your children are going to be even farther apart from the children of the elite who have been upgraded.
The poor get dumber.
Right, because they've been upgraded.
Yeah.
And you can't afford to upgrade your children. So that's just something else that just struck me. And I'm going to include this in my next presentation when we talk transhumanism again. Probably going to cite this when we complete our book, Rise of the Cyber Gods.
Well, and that'll come out sometime, probably third or fourth quarter next year.
Yeah.
You're going to be giving a talk for the upcoming Quest for Truth?
Yes. That is Saturday the 8th and Sunday the 9th of November. We will both be talking on Saturday night, and I'll be talking about the Dominionist movement.
Mm-hmm. And I think I'm talking earlier in that day.
You're talking on Sunday.
Morning.
You're talking on Sunday afternoon. So,
and Sam is talking both times.
He'll be in the background snoring away.
Can you sing? Hi, can you sing? Can you sing?
No.
Come on, you can do it.
He's asking if he's getting paid for this because it's 5 o'clock, which is his dinner time. So, if you want information on the Quest for Truth virtual conference, you don't need to leave the comfort of your own home to participate. It is online at theq4tconference.com. We've got links to that at pidradio.com. And then the following weekend, we're participating in two conferences virtually. There's a conference in upstate New York, a conference. Pastor Tony Goddard is at his church. Has got David Hamblin, who will be there at his church in person, and then we will be Skyping in with our presentations, but then later in the day.
He asked us to come in person, but we just couldn't do it this time of year.
Limited amount of vacation time in my day job. And then on the 15th, 14th and 15th of, the 15th of Saturday of November, that is the Prophecy Forum Conference in Dublin, Ohio. Yeah, and later that day, we'll be participating in a roundtable forum on transhumanism. And that will be at 3 in the afternoon Central Time.
And they'll have a water cooler. So if you get
one.
To go,
yes.
A real one. So if you want to go to Dublin, Ohio and participate in the live water cooler event, bring your own water cooler.
Or at least your own styrofoam cup.
Yes, exactly. You don't want to use those cups over and over again. You never know.
Yeah.
Mary says, LOL, Sam.
Yeah.
You never did sing.
And thanks to Scott Conway. I appreciate the vote of confidence. He wrote that I am more trustworthy a source than Louis Farrakhan. So I appreciate that.
I would say so.
Although he said, what is frightening or telling is when we here in the fringe Christianity community start saying the same things as guys like Louis Farrakhan has been talking about.
I know, that really disturbs me when that happens, but what are you going to do?
Well, the difference between us and him is we footnote and cite our sources.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. In fact, the book that I have coming out on Ebola has tons of citations at the back.
Yeah, so, but again, these things were prophesied 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the whole point of Sharon's book, that Revelation 6 may contain some clues that relate to what we're seeing.
The coming pandemic.
Exactly. And Jesus said that in the time of the end, the signs would include wars and rumors of wars and pestilence and earthquakes in diverse places. So these are things that we knew were coming. And while it certainly is going to be a bumpy ride, regardless of when the Lord comes to return, returns to call us home, whether it's, pre-trib, pre-blood moon, or red moon, pre-wrath, wherever, pre-millennial, whenever that happens, there's likely to be some very unpleasant things that take place around us. And we know that we cannot depend on the humans around us necessarily for strength. We know that we can depend on Him absolutely.
Absolutely. That is so true. Well, Jesus Christ is coming back. I'm a pre-tribber. You can argue with me on that if you want to, but I believe it, and I believe that He's going to come back any minute. But before that happens, there's no guarantee that you or I or any of our friends or loved ones are going to make it until he comes back for his church. If you don't know Christ, don't assume you have time to make up your mind, because that truck around the corner may just have your name on it.
Exactly. Exactly. Prepare as though today is your last.
Mm-hmm.
But then live as though, well, you live as though time is short.
And the reason for studying prophecy is not only so that we can see what's coming ahead and get excited and anticipate his return, not excited about the bad things, but anticipating the wonderful things that are going to come when Christ reigns during that thousand-year period and after, when there's a brand new heaven and earth. But you study prophecy so that we can get excited about the gospel. It should spur us on to tell people we love. Time is short.
Absolutely.
You've got to accept him and do it soon, and just don't do it, you know, by God, I'm going to bludgeon you over the head till you can accept Christ. You got to love, love, love. And
exactly.
it's a hard line to walk. Telling the truth about scripture, it can be so frightening and indicting, and it should be indicting.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, really loving the person, it's the sin that's evil.
Yeah.
It's the person that God died for.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll say something I've said before, so forgive me for repeating myself, but Christ on the cross forgave those who nailed him to that cross. How then can we justify bearing a grudge against someone who said an unkind thing?
Exactly. Exactly. We in the with the body of Christ need to love one another.
Yeah.
Love one another. Love one another. Because sadly, as we reach that ending tipping point when Christ does return, I believe that the body of Christ has an autoimmune disease.
We're attacking ourselves.
We are attacking ourselves.
Yes, that's right. The inward-facing firing squad.
Yeah. Yeah. Friendly fire.
Yeah. On A View from the Bunker this weekend, Dr. Judd Burton, our friendly neighborhood PhD.
Ooh,
yeah, it's become
friendly
sort of
neighborhood October guy.
Yeah, it's become sort of a tradition because of his study into, what does he call it, lycanthropy?
Lycanthropy,
study of werewolves, and his research into the Nephilim and the possible origins of the myths of vampires and zombies, perhaps, werewolves, perhaps, originating in the stories of the Nephilim that survived the Ark and were spread through various cultures around the world. He pointed out in the interview that there are references in the Epic of Gilgamesh that appear to reference zombies.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so you'll find that out. That'll be posted tomorrow on VFTB.net. I was a couple of days late, still haven't posted it yet, but the interview recorded with Chris Putnam at the Pikes Peak Prophecy Summit about his book, The Supernatural Worldview. I will get that posted tonight, Saturday, the 25th of October.
That explains why Chris Putnam has been hanging around our front door.
Yeah, yeah. So that'll be posted tonight. Mm-hmm. Judd Burton tomorrow. And then interesting discussion coming up. I've got to schedule the interview, but looking forward to talking with Dr. Rick Strassman.
Oh, yes.
In the near future.
Yes.
He wrote a book about several years ago about his research into DMT, which is a chemical produced by the pineal gland in small amounts. Dr. Michael Bennett, did an excellent presentation on that at the Nashville summit that we were at several years ago.
You need to get him back on, too.
To discuss it, right. Dr. Strassman wrote a book called DMT, the Spirit Molecule, and about how people taking DMT were apparently able to see into other realms.
Yeah.
They weren't just hallucinating. They were actually seeing into different spiritual realms. He's written a new book in which he posits the theory that it is through DMT that Yahweh communicated with the Old Testament prophets.
Now, before you jump all over that, cut him some slack. He's not a Christian. He is trying to figure it out.
Yes.
And he's doing it from a position of studying this chemistry. So we're trying our best to give him an opportunity to figure it out the same way we did. So pray for him. He really does want to find the truth. So pray for Dr. Rick Strassman.
Yeah. And he has come a ways from his... He was raised in a Jewish household, rejected that, went into Eastern mysticism and Buddhism in particular, and through the course of the DMT research came to reject the Buddhist view, the Buddhist worldview, and is now, at least as of the time of his writing, trying to synthesize the Bible, or at least the Torah, with this mechanism through which he believes God communicated with the prophets. Now, where that leads him, we don't know, but it should be a really interesting discussion. I just need to communicate with him and set up the interview. But that's something you'll look forward to in the next couple of weeks. That's at vftb.net. So,
well, we've probably gone over 60 minutes. That's why Sam came in here. But yes. We started late, so.
Yeah. But until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content, copyright Gilbert House, and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is